on the download from the film First Reform, filmmaker Paul Schrader, the owner and CEO of Flowers for Dreams, Stephen Dime, and graphic artist Molly Crabapple. Now, here's your host, a man who is struggling to find a Mother's Day gift for his cats, Justin Kaufman.
Should be from his cats. I'm not giving mothers. They're not my mother. But I'm in that weird spot where I have two cats, and this is our first Mother's Day with two cats. And there's an expectation that they will give a gift to my wife. Is that a thing, Pete? That's a thing? Do you have to sort of take on the with your awesome Instagram loving pets? Do you have to take on and essentially buy presents for Mother's Day?
No. I don't.
Yeah, see, I feel like the expectations on me that I could be like, oh, look what Mittens got you. Oh, look. Now, and the question is, do I get like a gift card where you're like, obviously the cat didn't do that? Or you try to fashion what you think a cat would give. So it's just like twigs and twigs and maybe a mouse, like a dead mouse, and be like, hey, I don't, you know, I don't know what's going through Mittens' mind, honey. Yeah, so I have to figure that out. I'm having a hard time. Because I feel like Mother's Day, which is a great holiday, it comes on the heels of my wife's birthday.
Ooh.
Yeah, so it's two in a row. So it's like just kind of like a 1-2 punch. And I obviously, you know, Mother's Day means a lot and it's important. And, you know, but I have to take on what my gift is going to be. Even though she's not my mother, but she's the mother of my child. And then I have to coordinate and oversee the present from the 10-year-old. And now I have to coordinate and oversee the present from the cats.
Oh, my gosh.
It's too much, man. It's too much. So I'm open to any gift ideas. If anyone out there is like, oh, you know what? I have the same issue. Justin, I got you covered. I'm down.
Yeah, I would love to hear.
I want to know what you got. Yeah,
our oldest dog turned 12 just recently, and she got a cake and we had a big celebration and hats and prizes and
great
things. And tomorrow we're taking them swimming.
That's the birthday present?
That's the birthday. They have big birthday present as we're taking to a pool. Like, they're going to be swimming in an indoor pool.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Fancy.
Do they go to, is that like a dog pool, or is it just you go to the Intercontinental and not tell them?
quick,
get in.
No, it's a place that's specifically designed for...
For dog
aquatics.
Dog aquatics. Oh, man, we might have to throw away the entire show tonight and talk about dog aquatics.
So I understand what it means to have a little pressure to give a gift. Or...
I can't wait till your dog looks at you and is like, this is what you got me? Dog aquatics? What? Come on. Maybe if I were 8, this would be suitable. This is not suitable.
Yeah, she'd just be happy with some beef.
Exactly. You're outdoing it. You're over. The expectations are too high. Yeah. It's the Download 720 WGN. Justin Kaufman here. We have a huge show lined up with you. We are with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Wow. I don't even want to go through the segments. There's so much to do tonight. I think there's 7 or 8 segments. Or like 10, 15 people coming through here. I'm feeling, I already, like, my heart is beating, like, from the anxiety and the stress, the sweat coming off the brow for all the segments that we're doing tonight. But I'm ready for it. I'm ready. Paul Schrader's going to be here, the filmmaker, longtime screenwriter of films like Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. He's got a new film, First Reform, starring Ethan Hawke, which is coming out. We're going to talk with him. Stephen Dime from Flowers for Dreams will be here, a Chicago company for the Download in Chicago business, talking about disrupting the florist and the flower industry. And a very special week for them because they are they're known for giving back to Chicago charities, and they got written up today in the Tribune about it. An amazing idea to sell $15 bouquets that you can donate to mothers who lost their children to gun violence. And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Stephen Dime here. Also, so much more. We're going to talk about Mother's Day. We get music. Also, Molly Crabapple, a huge artist with her new book. It's going to be great. Big show tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back, and we will do the carryout, so stay with us. It's The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. All right, here today's top stories. President Trump was praised for his work in getting North Korea to release American detainees. This in part because of his work the team has done in negotiating peace in that area. It shows that Trump is getting results. Then he speaks. And he realized that the president's worst enemy is his mouth and, of course, his fingers. On the tarmac last night, he said, "We want to thank Kim Jong-un, who really was excellent to these three incredible people." Okay, well, then why were they detained in the first place? And could you please remind everyone that they murdered another American and they have a history of unlawfully imprisoning our people? And then the tweets, which essentially find a way to blame Obama, which forgets the part that two of these Americans were detained during Trump's presidency. What? You know that old Scat Cat Paula Abdul song? I think it's best. Two steps forward, two steps back, and opposites attract. I can't stay mad at you, Donald. Trump lawyer Michael Cohen allegedly was pitching himself to big companies and lobbyists as the fixer who could get them access to the president. You give me a ton of money, I'll tell you what kind of sandwich the president likes. It rhymes with border mounder, malay of dish, bot rapple cry. Likes the hot apple pie. Trump lawyer Michael Cohen. This should silence critics that say that this FBI investigation into Trump lawyer Michael Cohen is a witch hunt and only about Stormy Daniels. Is it? Or is it possible that Cohen was using his influence to get huge payouts? Let's hope that's all it was. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson had a presser this morning to boast about taking over 100 high-powered assault rifles off the streets. This is good news after the bad news of a tremendously bloody weekend in Chicago where 85 people were shot. The guns on the table press conference, though, I don't know. Can we do away with that? It just seems like we've seen it before. That was a Gary McCarthy staple. I'm not sure what we're supposed to do with that info. And not just McCarthy, it was Daley, too. Remember that? Remember when Daley wanted to stick the gun up the rear end of the reporter, Mick Dumpke? Remember that? That was at one of these same things. Like, look at all these guns. It's obviously not working. I don't know. Maybe it's time for a new approach. Today, former police board president Lori Lightfoot announced she's entering the race for mayor to unseat the incumbent, Rahm Emanuel. This is interesting because she'll be running on the need for more police reform. So McCarthy will hit Emanuel from the right, Lightfoot from the left. Vallis will hit him on education. The whole mayoral election is setting up to be like Infinity Ward. It's everyone with their one superpower against Thanos who wants to destroy the world. I mean, get another term in office. Former Congressman Mel Reynolds sentenced to prison for not paying his taxes. This dude either hates the law so much or just really likes prison. Could be one of the two. The Chicago guy who played the awesome prank of filing a change of address for UPS headquarters, he's being charged with mail fraud. I don't know. All jokesters should go ahead and get a GoFundMe page going, right? He proved an awesome point that nobody is paying attention to anything. Don't be all embarrassed and clutch your pearls, UPS. You've been had. Oh, wait, he was actually stealing money and opening up credit cards in UPS executives' names? Yeah, not as funny. Still funny? No, not funny. Great. How do I delete a GoFundMe page? Is there a button on here? Spotify announced they're putting R. Kelly back in the closet. They are taking the embattled singer's music off of playlists on their platform. Kelly has been accused of sexual misconduct a lot. So next time you bob your head up and down to bump and grind, take a good look at yourself. In weather, it seems nice enough, right? In sports, both the Cubs and the Sox have the day off before they get at each other tomorrow night for the old, tomorrow day, for the old Crosstown Classic. Wasn't there a cup at one point? We get rid of the cup. That would be a good swap meet. I've got the cup. The series isn't huge for either squad, as one, it's early in the season, and two, it's May, and three, it's early in the season. The Cubs are right on the heels of the Cardinals in the NL Central, where the Sox are percentage points ahead of the Orioles for the number one pick in next year's draft. But it really doesn't matter. It's the Cubs-Sox game at Wrigley, right? If I were the Sox, this would be a perfect time to call up Eloy Jimenez. Have him play against the Cubs, who traded him away. And what's with no Jose Quintana in this series? Really? He's not scheduled to pitch at all? Yeah, no need. Why? Yeah, no need for a little fun. Who needs it? Just make it a regular game. The Celtics beat the Sixers. They head to the Eastern Conference Finals to take on LeBron and the Cavs. The Celtics are without their two stars, Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward, both brought in last offseason for this very shining moment, which they're not here for. Tonight is Game 7 of the Nashville-Winnipeg series. Last night I said it was last night, but it's this night. Get your story straight, Kaufman. Anyway, same feelings apply. Go Winnipeg. I don't know why I don't like Nashville. Oh, that's right, I do, because they don't like me. Remember they pulled that garbage a few years back saying we couldn't buy tickets for their playoff games? Get out of here. That would never happen in Winnipeg, right? They'd welcome us Hawks fans with open arms, and no fiddles up there either. Grant. Bears news, maybe not news, but rumors. The Bears need a pass rusher, right? Former Seahawks outside linebacker Cliff Avril is available. He's good. Not the greatest name, but still proven player on a proven winner. The best name, Raheem Nunez-Rochus. Great name. Defensive lineman just cut by the Chiefs. Might be worth a look. And finally tonight, a new study says that Chicago commuters are among the happiest in the nation. Yep. We let gridlock just slide right off. It's true. Every time I encounter a happy community, they're just waving their hands at me. Well, maybe not the whole hand, but maybe just one finger, but still, so happy. Oh, you're happy too? That's the carryout for May 10, 2018. It's such a nice night for gelato. We don't have any. But if you like frozen ice cream that breaks the spoon when you try to scoop it, then you're in the right place. Coming up, downloading Chicago Business. Stephen Dime is here from Flowers for Dreams. Talk about their business disrupting the flower industry. And also coming up at 8 o'clock, Paul Schrader, the writer of films like Taxi Driver and Raging Bull, has a new film called First Reformed. My guest at the big table, so stay with us. All right, Rob Martier, how are you, man?
Oh, man, so good to turn on ESPN last night, the Total Sports Network, and see wall-to-wall coverage of LeBron James. I was very happy about that. That was great. That was awesome.
I saw the
piece. And he didn't even play.
I know. I know. It's amazing. I saw the piece today on ESPN that was already saying that is LeBron James the greatest basketball player of all time, and it was a picture of him taller than Michael Jordan. I'm like, he hasn't won yet. If he loses, you know, if he doesn't even get out of the Eastern Conference Finals or the Finals, like,
right.
I don't know. And I don't remember Jordan ever losing, but who am I?
No,
he didn't. I'm just a casual observer.
By last count, it was six NBA championships.
Yeah. So, I have no skin in the game. You know, just casual guy who's just looking at the numbers. And
I hear you.
I say MJ, but who am I?
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
Yes, that's right. It is time for the download on Chicago Business, brought to you by Signature Bank. It's our weekly segment where we talk with CEOs and small business owners. They tell us their stories so we can better understand ours. Tonight, just in time for Mother's Day, we talk flowers. Florists in the flower delivery industry is a multi-million dollar pursuit, with national companies shipping flowers at high speeds all around the country. But for the Chicago company Flower for Dreams, the goal is to be local. The company, in operation since 2012, recognized that florists and flower delivery could be improved upon when it comes to product and distribution models. So Flowers for Dreams committed itself to local, organic flowers, fair pricing, and an effort to be local. Each month, they set aside a portion of their proceeds to charity. This month, the charity is MASC, Mothers Against Senseless Killing. 25% of the proceeds will go to the Chicago organization that's fighting violence block by block. In addition to that, Flowers for Dreams also sold $15 bouquets to donate for a mom who's lost her child to gun violence. The bouquets, they sold out. And there are big plans for expansion with this company. Tomorrow, Flower for Dreams will open their first shop in Milwaukee, and they're expanding their footprint in Chicago, coming downtown in June. Stephen Dime is the co-founder and CEO for Flowers for Dreams, and he's my guest tonight, the Download in Chicago business. Stephen, thanks for being here.
Good to be here. Excited to talk.
So, all right. So, first off, let's talk about the, you know, this is the charity, of course, and Heidi Stevens had a big article today in the Chicago Tribune about giving to this charity. You choose a charity every month. This month, to give give proceeds to MASC and to have this special thing to give bouquets of flowers to moms who have lost children. Where's this come from?
You know, this is one of the more proud charity partnerships we've done. And you're right, we choose a different charity each month and we give them a quarter of our profits from all our flower sales. So May, Mother's Day being kind of the quintessential May holiday, and for flowers, one of our Super Bowl periods in a year, it felt like a perfect month to kind of showcase and be spokespeople for Mothers Against Senseless Killings. They're a phenomenal organization based in Inglewood, which often has a really negative reputation and certainly is kind of riddled with violence, gang violence and gun violence. And these moms who have been affected by gun violence and have lost people to gun violence have decided to get out on the street, make themselves known by having block parties and sitting out with cookouts on street corners. And many of them have lost children to gun violence. So we said, you know, hey, this month we're going to be ordering, you know, servicing a lot of bouquets for Mother's Day. Let's give some to moms who, you know, may not have anyone to send to them anymore. You know, Chicago is kind of one community. We wanted to show that moms from one area can send to another. And it was a huge success. In 4 hours, we sold out.
Like that. And the messages, and Heidi published some of those messages, but the messages that were sent along from people is pretty inspiring.
It was amazing.
It's very emotional. Let's talk about this. Why do you give 25% of your proceeds to a charity each month? Because that seems like a lot. I'm not trying to downplay giving charitable donations, but a quarter of your proceeds. How do you succeed in giving away that kind of cash?
Yeah, it is a lot, and it makes it a fun and interesting challenge constantly to kind of make our business work around it. And I think it's a great challenge that most businesses should kind of instill. And, you know, when we set out to create Flowers for Dreams in 2012, there was three main criteria that we thought could be better in the floral industry. One, kind of accessibility. The price felt either deceptive when it was an online company or just really expensive to send with delivery a bouquet
deceptive
from a local
how?
Florist.
I mean, just the idea that...
You know, starting at $19.99 and there's teddy bears and there's balloons and there's deluxe and there's $25 shipping. All of a sudden you're at $65 and it shows up in a box and it's not necessarily what you pay for. And, you know, we wanted to create an experience. When we started, we were in our early 20s, just out of college. We started flower peddling when we were 19. So we've been in the industry a while. We said, you know, we can't spend $60, $80, $100, $150 for flowers, and they should be enjoyed more often. So that was a key criteria. But we also had this social conscience aim where it was, we kind of wanted to be the socially conscious alternative. Everything was built on a company that would better reflect our preferences aesthetically, our budget abilities as millennials, and our concern for having companies and supporting companies that care about the community. So it was very important from the beginning to incorporate giving into our model.
For you to start as flower peddling at a young age and to turn it into the successful business that is Flowers for Dreams, you know, talk about that journey, because, you know, automatically you're already going into an area when you talk about florists and flower delivery that people have cornered the market. You've got your corner store, which is taking care of a neighborhood, and then you've got these national brands that they're able to flood the market with commercials and advertising, right, and be able to really point people to their product. How do you find a footprint or a foothold in the flower business when you're an upstart, anew?
So I actually think that there's a huge gap. You're right. There's the local mom and pop, and they are, artistry is their keynote thing. You know, they're good artists. They make a great bouquet. And then there's the online companies that have outsourced the entire process, and they're the opposite of artisans, right? They're a marketing company in many cases. They don't actually fulfill their own orders in a lot of cases. So we felt there was this gap where we had an opportunity. We kind of fashioned ourselves a hybrid between the local mom and pop and the online company. So our storefronts, our website, primarily, the vast majority of our orders come in online, but we fulfill it all in-house. We source our own flowers. We design our own flowers. We deliver them all by hand like a local florist would. So we kind of can give the price of a more online company, right, but have the experience that's local.
And that's really where you can improve upon the industry, is that ability to have that front-facing, that storefront to be the website. And that's really what sets you guys apart, that, you know, you're not going to a shop. I mean, you could, but you're not going into the Flowers for Dreams shop that's on the corner, you're actually going through the process that is very organic and authentic at this point, just going through the web and being able to then use the what has always been the staple of the floral industry, use prompt delivery and local product to get it there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, so let's talk about – well, let's do this. Let's take a quick break so we stay on time because I want to talk about the challenge of expansion because we mentioned at the beginning tomorrow starts in Milwaukee. You got plans for a new shop downtown to – and this is – that'll be a challenge as well to get out of the neighborhoods and come downtown. In studio, Stephen Dime. He's a co-founder and CEO of Flowers for Dreams, a great floral company here in Chicago that's disrupting the flower industry as we know it. He's my guest tonight in the Download in Chicago Business. Stay with us.
It's business time.
It's a Download in Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. Stephen Dime's in tonight. He's a co-founder and CEO of Flowers for Dreams, which is the disrupting the floral industry as we know it. A local company right there on Hubbard, near West Side here, plans to expand. They've got an opening of a shop tomorrow in Milwaukee. They're actually opening up down here in Chicago, downtown Chicago in June. You know, for you, what you push forward is that you're a local business and that you give a quarter of your proceeds, monthly proceeds, to charity. That's a big part of your selling point. It's a marketing. How do you make money when you're doing that? I mean, this is a business that has a lot of turnover. There's if you think about it, you have to have fresh products, so there's not a lot of inventory. There's not a lot of wiggle room when it comes to how much money's coming in and how much money's going out. How do you make money in flowers?
No question. And it's a great question. I love answering it now because I've started to kind of look at that as, you know, and I almost wish to encourage other business owners to do the same. I look at it as an unchangeable fact for our business, and we have to work around and make our business work to ensure that we can keep giving to charity as a fundamental part of our business. It's so much in our DNA. But how we actually make it happen, and right when we started, we knew the key factor in flowers is inventory and spoilage. So our industry trade association reveals that 35% of waste exists for an average florist. So one of every three stems dies before it sells. So we figured if we could eliminate spoilage to a large degree, we could create a more competitive price and we could afford in our margin to give to charity. So early on, we decided to, you know, when we started, we only had one bouquet in our menu. One bouquet, it was $35, it's free delivery. Now we have four bouquets.
I was going to say, I remember maybe two.
Possibly, yeah. Slowly, you know, a few more options. Right, but it allows us to keep, you know, flexible industry. Right. We're not kind of at the behest of what roses changed to.
And that's a really interesting point because variety has always been, and you kind of mentioned it before with some of the bigger companies, that's what they're selling. They're selling the way that you can modify and adjust and you can make your own, you can customize. But that starts to cost the consumer money. There is something in the idea of saying this is what we offer. It's one bouquet. That's two bouquets. That's the idea. Take it or leave it.
Exactly. And I think when confronted with that choice as a customer, would you rather pay $35 with free delivery, often on a bicycle, delivered by hand, the whole experience, but not be able to select roses, lilies, tulips precisely and kind of take it as like a chef's recommendation as you would a restaurant? Or would you rather pay $100 and have it delivered in a UPS box and be able to choose roses, right, right, lilies, tulips? Exactly. And I think most customers will choose the former.
And I see how that would bring down the cost of spoilage because you're in control of what the actual product is.
Right.
For you, as you expand, I mean, let's talk about that. I mean, you've had such success in the last 5-6 years here in Chicago. You've become people know the brand. They've been writing about it in the Tribune today. You're definitely getting traction in the Chicago area. You have to kind of throw all that away to start fresh in a new town, starting tomorrow in Milwaukee. What did you learn from starting fresh in Chicago that you're going to apply to what you do in Milwaukee?
Well, you know, naturally as flower peddlers when we were 19, where this all started, we're really scrappy. We hustle. I was in Milwaukee today. I just got back here in Chicago. I'm all over the place. My co-founder Joe is the same. Our whole team is. We really kept that mentality of, you know, hawking a bouquet on the street. Every bouquet counts and every customer counts. So I think, you know, that's kind of cliche to say, but it truly is a differentiator when we care in that way for each customer, each order. We may see many bouquets. Really, the customer sees one, and that's our care. I mean, for us in expansion and what we're trying to do is, you know, we don't want to, you know, it's been great growing in Chicago. I appreciate the recognition of our brand. And Milwaukee's kind of a natural next step because we can leverage a lot of the supply chain and logistics we've built here pretty easily, being 90 minutes away. But what's happening in floral is happening in a lot of smaller industries. And it's like the rise of craft. So we saw it in beer 30 and 40 years ago, coffee maybe sooner. You know, it used to be just Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts on the street. And now we have all these amazing third wave coffee roasters that are offering a local, small batch, independent, high quality alternative. And we think customers want the same in flowers. And that's what's happening. We hope we can kind of usher in a craft flower movement, the same thing that's happened.
Do you have to reprogram the customer? Because there is something to be said about, I mean, there's, I think right away in my head, I think New York City, and I think, you know, bodegas that are out and you just grab the flower that are there and pull it, or in the grocery store. Do you have to think about reprogramming customers to understand what you're trying to do?
Well, you know, I think that could be a part of our movement, right? We want to make flowers more accessible. In fact, you talk about Manhattan or San Francisco or LA, you can buy flowers on every street corner. So in 2016, we actually got an ordinance overturned here in Chicago to allow flowers to be permittable on the street.
Up to that point, it wasn't.
Up to that point, for 70 plus years, it wasn't. And then we had the first flower truck ever, also written about in the Tribune, that still exists in Chicago, and it's been here for now a third season. We wander around the streets and sell flowers. So we want to make flowers more accessible. We want more flower carts and more flower trucks. And we want the bodega atmosphere that New York has. Because again, we want to create a flower buying experience that feels easy. Not, oh my God, it's $100. How can I send this more than once a year?
Why Chicago? I mean, obviously you've had to go against the grain to change laws and ordinances in the city to be able to accommodate this kind of business. But you talked about places like L.A., San Francisco, New York City, who don't have those things. So what is it about Chicago that is a town that you chose to set up Flowers for Dreams?
Well, the truth for us is, I'm from here. I came back here in college when it was, and I keep hearkening back to that. I needed a way to make extra money. I wasn't jumping on a plane to New York or L.A. to hawk flowers. It was right in my backyard. But what I've learned that makes Chicago special and kind of the heartland in general, and why we're thinking about Milwaukee and the Midwest in particular, is there truly is an appreciation for the level of customer service and the level of quality we have in a different way. And I don't want to, you know, discount the coast, where sometimes convenience and luxury, I think, often are a little bit more overvalued in some of those markets. So we're not the Uber for flowers. Our main catch is not that it's speedy, not that you can order it really quickly off an app. Our thing is, again, local, small batch, independent. We'll support local charities. It's going to be really a high quality experience. And I think that's something that we found that isn't unique to Chicago, but something that these cities in the Midwest really value.
As old as new again, right?
For sure.
This month, Mother's Day, of course, around the corner right here, but the we talked about a little bit earlier, the charity that Flowers for Dreams are giving to this a quarter of their proceeds is MASC, Mothers Against Senseless Killing. 25% of the proceeds go to this Chicago organization that's fighting violence block by block. The $15 bouquets are sold out. You did that in 4 hours, but that was to be able to send flowers to a mom who lost their child to gun violence. And that was written up today by Heidi Stevens in the Chicago Tribune. Stephen Dime, co-founder and CEO of Flowers for Dreams here in Chicago and Milwaukee and downtown Chicago, coming up in June. Stephen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, the new film First Reformed is out in select theaters coming up on May 25th. The film stars Ethan Hawke, Cedric the Entertainer, and Amanda Seyfried, and centers around a fascinating story about the church, activism, and climate change. What does God think of what we're doing to the planet? The film is written and directed by longtime filmmaker Paul Schrader. Schrader's most known for writing Martin Scorsese films like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, and The Last Temptation of Christ. But that's just a sliver of the work that Schrader has done in Hollywood. He's directed many of his own films, including American Gigolo with Richard Gere, among several others. Schrader has either directed or written 30-plus films in his career. His latest, First Reformed, hits select theaters on May 25th, and it's my pleasure to welcome filmmaker Paul Schrader to The Download tonight. Mr. Schrader, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Justin.
I love this film, and I have a question. In your bio, it talks about with Calvin College. You studied theology. Talk about this film, why you made this film, and what it has to do with religion and activism.
Well, I was in the product of the Christian Reformed Church. Westside Christian, growing up, was Christian High, Calvin College. And, you know, movies were sort of the forbidden fruit. I didn't see them when I was younger. Yeah. So I came to movies as an adult, as a college student. And the first movies I was drawn to was the intellectual European cinema of the 60s, Bergman, Antonioni, and so forth. So that was kind of the door I walked in. And then I wrote a book about theological aesthetics about some of those filmmakers. But I never thought that I would actually work in that style. Once I crossed over into filmmaking, I was just too intoxicated with action and empathy and sex and violence to worry much about doing something on the aesthetic or the spiritual side. And that was pretty well it till about 3 years ago when I was talking with a director who had done this film, Ida, and we started talking about spiritual films. And it suddenly occurred to me on the walk home, I says, you know, it's time now.
Mm-hmm.
All your life you say, I'll never write that movie. Well, it's time to write it now.
It has a lot of similarities to your more recognizable work, whether it be Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Down the Line. But it has this man-in-room philosophy, this concept of the main character, Ethan Hawke, who is writing in his diary, he's sitting down, he has a place, he's a man in a room, he goes and does stuff, and he comes back to the room. Why shoot it this way?
When in 1969, I saw Pickpocket when I was a critic for the L.A. Free Press, and I was knocked out by this movie. I just didn't know movies could act in that way and it could lift your soul that way. And that was the man in the room. So the first script I wrote 2 years later was Taxi Driver, and that man was lonely. And he was a taxi driver. Then the next time he showed up, he was narcissistic and he was a gigolo. And then he showed up again and he was a drug dealer and he was anxious.
Mm-hmm.
Then he showed up again. He was a society walker and he was superficial. And now he's shown up again and he's a reverend and he's in despair.
As a writer, as a filmmaker, do you see the same character just floating through the movies that you do?
Well, you can't write about him every year. I mean, you can't do a Woody Allen. But as your life progresses, every decade or so, you find yourself circling back around that sort of character. It's not a necessary progression, mm-hmm. you know, but it's just, you know, where am I in my life now
right.
in terms of that character? I certainly am not where I was, you know, when I did Taxi Driver.
And to think that, like I said, 35 plus movies that you've done in your career, how important is it for the film to be autobiographical as a writer to have elements of who you are as a person?
They will always be there. For my part, I wrote one film that was sort of about my father and one film that was sort of about my mother, and I think they're two of the weakest films I've done.
Really?
I think the stronger ones that are a little further away from me, that are more metaphorical. You know, I was never a taxi driver. I was never a drug dealer. And those, in fact, are stronger. And I think I was just a little too close to the stove when I did the films about my parents.
And it really does. It makes me curious in knowing that you have a background in religion and knowing as well how you write to the man in the room and as we just talked about, kind of being the same character. Where do you see this film when it comes to your life and who you are? Is there a strong pull for you to think about both the idea of what you're supposed to be as a priest and also what activism and belief and passion drive
you
to?
Well, I mean, there's a definite end of times feeling to this film, an eschatology of sorts. And we are living in dire times. There's a good possibility that our species will not see out this century. So that does make you think. You know, for 10,000 years, human beings have been having this discussion, but it was always hypothetical. Why are we here? Where are we going? Etc. And then I would have that discussion and I would die and my son would have it and his son would have it. Well, maybe we're starting to look at the last few generations of people who are even going to have that discussion.
Right.
That lends a kind of weight and heaviness and gravitas to what had been for so many years a dorm school reverie.
It's great and because the character, the main character played by Ethan Hawke, is called to counsel one of his parishioners, and he's an environmental activist. And his big question to the priest in this scenario is, how can I bring, he's expecting, and how can I bring a child into this world when we know that it's about to die? And what I love about the film is that the priest doesn't shun that, doesn't necessarily say, oh, please, you know, double down. He can't answer the question, and it eats at him.
Yeah, well, I mean, the very fact that young people would be having this question in times of plenty. You can understand it in times of starvation. But when we are living in times of plenty, and now we're worried about bringing children into the world who are going to suffer because of our greed, suffer terribly. Mm-hmm. You know, the very fact that you can have this discussion is chilling. And I've never had it, but I know my kids have it.
And your characters are as well. Paul Schrader, my guest tonight, the filmmaker behind First Reformed, starring Ethan Hawke, Cedric the Entertainer, and Amanda Seyfried, which is out in theaters on the 25th. A longtime filmmaker, also the writer of Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Last Temptation of Christ. The list goes on and on and on. Paul Schrader, my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, filmmaker and writer, he's done so many different things in his career. Paul Schrader, his new film, First Reformed, is out in select theaters coming up on the 25th. It stars Ethan Hawke, Cedric the Entertainer, Amanda Seyfried. The credits, and I know that I wonder how you feel about, I keep continually throw back to The Taxi Drivers, The Raging Bull, to The Last Temptation of Christ, the movies that you did with Martin Scorsese. Do you feel like that is something that you want in the lead and that you want to discuss, or is that something you're like, all right, time to move on?
Yeah, well, a little bit of both. I always said that no matter what we do, we're always going to get, the obit's going to read, The Maker of Taxi Driver. I was speaking with Nick Cage, and after he saw First Reformed, and he said, well, I hope they changed that obituary to Taxi Driver and First Reformed.
Well, there is something to be said, because you have, in that article, in that discussion you had with Nick Cage in Interview Magazine, you talk about this being your masterpiece. How so?
Well, it just brings so many things together. 50 years ago, I realized I might want to become a screenwriter, and I realized I wanted to write a book about spiritual cinema. And now, 50 years later, those two threads have come back together. So there is a sense of completion. Mm-hmm. In the Ride the High Country, the Sam Peckinpah film, Joel McRae, somebody asked him what he wants, and he said, all I want to do is enter my house justified. And so after this one, I sort of feel that I can enter my house justified.
The characters that you've created, and just mentioning a couple of the films, they're iconic because of the characters. The scripts are amazing, and they always are, but when you talk about Taxi Driver, the reason that it resonates and continues for years after years is the internal and external struggle of the main character, played by Robert De Niro in that film. You know, when you think about that, and I think about the characters that you're creating, is that how you forge? Is that how you create a film? You think about the character first?
It goes problem, metaphor. And the metaphor is usually a character. So if the problem is loneliness, the metaphor is a taxi driver. If the problem is inability to express love, the character is the gigolo, If the problem is despair, the character is a military chaplain. Mm-hmm. So then you start evolving a plot. But if the metaphor is nice and strong, the plot just becomes certain things that happen. Mm-hmm. It's not plot driven. It's just the plot makes the metaphor richer and richer.
What is it about the concept of despair that makes great characters? Because you mentioned despair with the military chaplain, Ethan Hawke, in this film. But there is something great about the dark, the loner, the character who wants to do right by this poisoned world, but in a way becomes part of the problem.
Yeah, well, the sickness unto death, as Kierkegaard called it. I mean, we all have good cause for despair. And he says in the course of that film that life is hope and despair. And you can't have one without the other. And you have to choose hope. Otherwise, you have despair. And so you can choose hope even if you don't have hope. Just like Camus once said, I choose to believe, I don't believe.
Yeah. Reading your story, and you talk about what was happening to you in your life as you were, before you wrote Taxi Driver, before you decided to even get into films, you were cast away a lot of your friendships and your family, and were living down and out and dealing with health issues. Is a lot of the despair and how you see despair come from your own life?
No. I actually think that I'm relatively easygoing. And I don't think that it is, just because you don't have hope doesn't mean you're in agony either. But this is getting to be very thick and dark and murky water here.
I apologize for that. That's what we do here at the big table. One quote that Nicolas Cage pulled out in the Interview magazine piece, and he said that you gave him this advice when he was younger, was the idea of that characters that raise more questions than answers have a longer shelf life. And I think of a lot of the characters that are in your films and ones that you've written, and this one fits the bill as well, Ethan Hawke's character, that there is this idea that they don't have to have all the answers, that actually presenting more questions at the end of the film is better for the audience.
Yeah, well, contradiction is the essence of character. You know, I loved her so much, I hit her. And she loved me so much, she hit me back. That we do contradictory things. We do things against our own best interests, and we don't know why. And so when characters do that, it helps us sort of relate our own behavior. You know, so when the Travis Bickle says, I do not believe that one should devote his life to morbid self-attention, well, that's all he is doing. He's devoting his whole life to morbid self-attention. But, you know, he says he isn't doing it.
Yeah, right.
And it's just the same thing like with freedom. Why do we talk about freedom so much? Because we're trying to justify the fact that we crave chains. And, you know, we have a desire to be chained. We don't really want freedom. But how do we explain this? Well, we say we want freedom.
Do you have to resist the urge as a screenwriter, as an artist, to answer all the questions? I mean, is there an urge to say this has to make sense or it won't make sense to the audience?
No, it has to be the other way. It has to be a certain room for mystery. You know, at a certain point, I don't know why he does this. I don't know why she says this. But I know she does. I know she opens her mouth and these words come out. And that's that. Mm-hmm. And when you allow room for things you don't fully understand, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. You know, I've often compared a critic and an artist to a medical examiner and a pregnant woman. The critic wants to get that body on the table, wants to cut it open and find out how it lived and died. That pregnant woman only wants to nourish that thing inside her and hopes it comes out alive. So if you let the critic into the birthing room, he will kill that baby.
The inner critic of whether or not you think audiences are going to like this part, if this makes sense, are they going to get this? Yeah. All that kind of stuff that goes through a writer's head.
Yeah.
So interesting. Paul Schrader, my guest, filmmaker. His film, First Reformed, is out in select theaters coming up on the 25th. It stars Ethan Hawke, Cedric the Entertainer, Amanda Seyfried. A fascinating story from a fascinating writer and director, longtime writer and director of films like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, Last Temptation of Christ, also his own film American Gigolo with Richard Gere. I mean, we can go down the line, the films that you've done. Paul Schrader in studio tonight at the big table. We'll take a break for the news and come back. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, my guest at the big table tonight, the filmmaker behind First Reformed, a new film that's out starring Ethan Hawke and others, Paul Schrader. Paul Schrader is in studio right now. The film First Reformed comes out on the 25th of May. Amazing to talk with you about the art of screenwriting, about character development, about religion, everything we've been talking about tonight. You have lived a life in Hollywood. It's amazing to think about the early days that we continue to mention, being almost a screenwriter exclusively for the early Martin Scorsese stuff, to taking on your own films, to writing huge films, to having films that were passion plays, to crowdfunding. You've done a lot in Hollywood. When you look back on your career, is it exactly how you thought it was going to go?
Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate. I got lucky. And, you know, there's always part of you that says, I wish I could start all over. And then you think, well, gee, if I start all over, maybe I won't get so lucky. I know I have had a very fortunate career. And, of course, I've also lived in the sweet spot of human history, the post-war baby boom, the least war, the most leisure time, the best medicine, the best standard of living, and my generation sucked all this up and then left nothing for their progeny.
That's a big theme in the film First Reformed, just as you tackle this concept that we are getting closer and closer to our demise as a human species and how humans are handling that huge question, especially people who are in the church and people who are spiritual.
Is that something that's on your mind? Is that something that as a filmmaker and as a screenwriter that you're thinking about, that the end of days are near?
Not the end of days, the end of Homo sapiens. First of all, the Earth is just fine. Totally nuke out the Earth in 50,000 years, it'll be great. You know, it'll be free of the virus called Homo sapiens. So it's just, you know, our ability to save ourselves. And I think we've taken the vote. I think the vote is in.
Yeah. I think about all the other films that you've done, and, you know, we could spend the next 20 minutes just talking about the late 70s. I was watching the Spielberg documentary that was on HBO not too long ago. And
I'm in there.
Yeah, right. But just this considerable amount of fanfare given to Hollywood in the late 70s with the Brat Pack.
I'll tell you what it was. The movies weren't necessarily better, and the filmmakers weren't necessarily more intelligent. The audiences were better. And the audiences took movies seriously. And when audiences turn to artists with serious questions, they will get great art. It just works that way. Today, audiences don't take movies very seriously, and it's much harder to make a serious movie. But back then, when we were dealing with these multiple crises of the sexual revolution, the gay revolution, the drug revolution, the military, you know, women's liberation, people wanted the movies to tell them, you know, what should we be thinking about this? And so when you have great audiences, you have great art.
It's also collaborative to look at that space and see all the great artists that were going to each other to talk about their work and to talk about what they might produce or what being on each other's set. It seems to be something different than what you see today. Do you see it that way?
It was a smaller town, you know. In the late 60s, 70s, you know, there were maybe 10, 15,000 people hustling. Now they're, you know, 200,000, 500,000, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the sense of community is gone.
And I think about this because I ask this question a lot, just this idea of even to be someone of your stature, Paul Schrader, with films that you've written that are part of the world, you know, the history of film, Taxi Driver and the like. There still is this idea that as you talk about just sheer numbers, or 15,000 hustlers in the late 70s, it's turned into millions of people trying to get the same thing that you have, that there is a fair amount of rejection, and there still is a fair amount of hustle that has to happen, even for someone accomplished in his 70s that has a body of work that should speak for itself.
Yeah, but also we have this explosion of media. So there are maybe 10 or so independent films a year that get their head above the crowd that people notice. Out of how many? Maybe 15,000, 20,000?
Crazy.
So the democratization of filmmaking has made it possible for anybody to make a film, and virtually impossible for anybody to make money.
That's the problem, right?
It's a nasty trade-off.
Yeah, right? As a writer, as someone who has really refined his craft and written screenplays that have actually transcended the film that they've actually been attached to, do you see Hollywood being a better place for writers? Do you see with all of the opportunities that are there for different media and for different collaborations that the writer's job is easier in 2018 than, say, it was in 1977?
Well, certainly long form. Long form lends itself to writer's strength as opposed to a director's strength. And so you get, you know, this great writing in long-form episodic TV. On the other hand, the center of the old theatrical market has fallen out. The center didn't hold. So those middle-budget films that dealt with social issues are virtually gone. And they have now migrated over to television, which is not quite as free as you think it is. And in fact, this film, First Reformed, was turned down by both Amazon and Netflix, both at the script stage and at the finish stage. So it's not like they are indiscriminately picking up things, because sometimes it seems like that when you look through the catalog of things.
But they're just another Hollywood studio.
Yeah, well, they are the Hollywood studio. I mean, the old studios are virtually gone now.
I think about having this opportunity to talk with you because I remember being a kid who was 10 years old, 12 years old, watching some of your films going, oh my God, there is a world out there, right? I think of not just Taxi Driver, but even what was the film, The Cat People? Scared the
bejesus out of me in the way of like, what is happening? Like, what is, I'm 10, 12 years old watching this on TV. And I think about all the films that you've done and all the films that have had impact on people, and think about Taxi Driver, Raging Bull are great examples of people who put that into posters, and it's, they can put it on their wall and it'll tell people who they are. Do you think about that? Do you think about the lasting, the indelible impact that you've had on American culture when it comes to some of the stuff that you've written and produced and shot and directed?
Well, I mean, what can you think about it? You know, sometimes you get lucky and you happen to become involved in something that becomes a milestone and a marker in cultural history. It's nothing you can really plan on, and you can't go back and say, oh, I should do another one of those, because you don't know how that one happened in the first place.
It's amazing to meet you, and the film First Reformed is out in theaters coming up on May 25th, a great film starring Ethan Hawke, Cedric the Entertainer, and Amanda Seyfried. It is Paul Schrader's masterpiece.
Thank you.
And Paul Schrader, the longtime filmmaker, in studio tonight, my guest at the big table. Paul, can't thank you enough. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Justin.
Download, Paul Schrader. Great to have him at the big table. A lot of films coming up here, summertime. A lot of directors we're going after and attempting to really be the place, be the authority for the filmmakers and writers. Because so many great people who have created great stuff that, you know, are behind, I don't want to say behind the scenes, because Paul Schrader is in front of the scenes, is iconic, but... You know, to say that you're the writer of Taxi Driver right away, people are like, Robert De Niro? No. But great. I am fascinated by the man in a room concept, this, and that's how he writes. Anyway, we'll see that First Reform coming out next week. Next week, we're going to talk with Bill Holderman. He's the director and writer of the new film Book Club, which stars Jane Fonda, Mary Steenburgen, Diane Keaton, Candace Bergen, about finding love,
wow,
sex, better relationships at a certain age.
That's a cast.
I know, right? Not even to mention the men. Andy Garcia's in it. Don Johnson. Don Johnson.
Don Johnson, all right.
That's Craig T. Nelson. You know, it's a good cast. That conversation's coming up next week, so we'll have that as well. All right, coming up, we're at the halfway point of the show tonight. I realized we didn't really do a billboard at the top because I was so concerned about what my cats should get my wife for Mother's Day.
Has anybody chimed in with thoughts?
No, nobody cares. They're like, yeah, no. They didn't give me anything.
Hmm.
I'm on my own on this one.
Oof.
I will say this. The segment coming up might be better to ask the women that are going to be in the segment coming up at 9 o'clock. We're going to talk motherhood for Mother's Day. Andrea Levoff, who's the creator of Dope Ass Moms, she was on the show before. I think it was last year, right around this time. She's here, and also some unbelievable people who are big in the blog industry here in Chicago. Cita Walters, Corey McFadden. It's going to be a great conversation about motherhood and young moms and pushing back on the stereotype of mom, and that's really what they do, and maybe they can help me. You know, I actually saw something that was awesome. I think it was on Corey's blog today. It is a cupcake bouquet. Are you paying attention to this? I'm going to ask her about it. She blogged about this idea is that you make the cupcakes, right? Then you get a flower pot, and you go to Michael's, and you get one of those almost like pin cushion type things, but are more like plastic, like round balls you put in there. And then you pin the cupcakes into that pin, and then you put some paper mache or something around it, and it makes it look like a plant, but it's cupcakes. How cool is that, huh? You think you could do that, Pete?
I could not.
I know. First thing I said, this is awesome. This would blow my wife's mind. If I did this with my son and we put this together, then I'm like, it ain't gonna look like that.
No.
It's gonna be sloppy. There's gonna be frosting everywhere. It's gonna look like my hydrangeas look. It's just not just gonna be all thorny.
Maybe this is something the cats can take on.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe I can make it real messy on purpose and be like, see, the cats did it, man. The cats did this for you. But it's a really cool look. It's on her. She does the a great blog, which is called glitterandbubbles.com. So anyway, we'll talk about that coming up. That's coming up at 9 o'clock. After that, and this is cool, we got some cool music coming through Chicago. King Tuff. King Tuff is a indie rock musician who is well known. He's coming to Chicago. I think the show's sold out even at this point. He's going to be in town this weekend. We'll talk with King Tuff about his career. That's coming up at 9:30. And then Molly Crabapple joins us, a graphic artist and sketch artist who went from... It's an amazing story. She was in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival, and she was a headliner for it. And because she was a sketch artist... She got her start, I love the story, she got her start sketching in the corner of a nightclub in New York City. So you know that the character Stefan on Saturday Night Live, when they're like, the newest nightclub is blah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course.
That's essentially where she worked. She worked in one, and she convinced the nightclub owner to let her sketch what was happening. And so it's one of these really glitzy, weird underground clubs where you would have a mixture of strange, rich Wall Street brokers and you know, the Smashing Pumpkins, or I don't know.
Just
everybody. So she would sketch the night. She'd sit in the corner and sketch the night. I don't know how she got paid or why, what they did. And they put the sketches up either, you know, on the walls. And then the economy busted in 2008, and she recognized the ridiculousness of being a sketch artist at a gluttonous club, mm-hmm. right off of Wall Street, and she ended up offering her services and becoming really the voice through sketches of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I've seen those sketches where she sketched a lot of the protests, and she's some tremendous artist. And she's turned that into a career, a worldwide career. Her latest book that she wrote with an exiled Syrian journalist, essentially she did the artwork. She did sketches. The journalist was in Syria, in Raqqa, and it was ISIS-controlled at the time, 2014, 2015. And he would smuggle out by sending photos to her. He would send them through his phone. He had different phones, and he would send these, take photos of what was happening there, and that was against the rule of ISIS. You can't send media out. And he would send it to her, and she would sketch the photo. So when he told his story and wrote his memoir, it's accompanied by this tremendous sketches of real life, life that's happening under ISIS rule in Raqqa, stuff that's never been seen before. That's what her new book is. It's amazing. Tremendous artist, Molly Crabapple, coming up at 10 o'clock tonight. So we got a great show, wow. Right? Isn't that cool?
That's all starting now?
That's all starting now. Oh, I know. As I said at the beginning, we were goofing around about the cat and Mother's Day. I didn't have a chance to tee up what was happening, but we've had quite a show already. These lights are giving me a headache.
It's getting a little bright over there.
Yeah.
TV, you know, it's for the TV.
It is. We do CLTV broadcasts at 9 o'clock for Cochrane and 3 o'clock for Roe. And they install these new lights in here. So the softer light, which is perfect, that kind of talk show light that you have, the Eric Bogosian talk radio vibe, those were replaced by really sterile TV white lights, like white. And when you get to about this time of night, they start to shine on you, and you're like,
I do a little show at this place called Chirp.
Yeah, of course,
Chirp. It's like a 107.1 FM if you're on the north side of Chicago, and I do this show and just play music. And I like lights. Like, when I come into the studio, I like lights. I like to get my setup.
Right. You like it clear.
And for as long as I've been there, the person that comes on after me, it's been a number of different people, you know, throughout the course of the time that I've been doing it, they always come in, whoosh, lights down, dimming everything. It's like pitch black in there, and nothing makes you feel old. You know,
like mood lighting.
Yeah, like when you have like all the lights on, and the person that comes in after you is like, "What do you want? Hey, old man, you know, turn down these lights, man. You're killing my buzz.
You're killing my buzz." Oh, I love it. I love it. Yeah, I feel the same way. Although. I'm the same way. I like to turn the lights like full on because I feel like it's a show, man. You're on a showcase studio.
Yeah,
you're
right.
You're in the Allstate Showcase Studio right here on Michigan Avenue. I want people to see it. I always get that vibe when you go to Times Square and you look up and Anderson Cooper's up there and the lights are bright.
Right.
That's what you want. Mm-hmm. Here. It just gives you a headache. That's all I'm saying.
Like if you walk by, if all the lights were down in here and somebody walked by on Michigan Avenue, they're like, nothing's going on in there. There's a guy playing radio. He's not even on doing anything.
That guy's sweeping up the studio.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And then dim lighting. Right. All right, so let's get the second half of the download started. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It is the download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 9:30 tonight, King Tuff joins us. He's going to be at Lincoln Hall coming up on, I think it's next weekend. The indie rocker brings his sound here to Chicago. Looking forward to that. He's join us, talk about his new music. That's coming up at 9 o'clock. And Molly Crabapple will be here at 10 o'clock. She's a graphic artist who was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. We'll talk about her new work, where she collaborated with an exiled Syrian journalist to do sketches for his book. It's really tremendous work, and I'm so looking forward to that conversation coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, Mother's Day, of course, this Sunday, a day to celebrate moms everywhere. And tonight, we thought we would talk about motherhood. My guest tonight makes her triumphant return to the download. Andrea Levoff is the creator of the web series and website Dope Ass Mom. She's a writer, a speaker, and a coach. She dedicates her work at Dope Ass Mom to discussing things that were never really told to her about being a mom, but also pushing back on society's image of motherhood. And she's brought in a few dope ass moms to talk motherhood tonight as well. Sita Walters is a mother of two boys and also a successful fashion and lifestyle blogger in town. You can find her work at clarkandstone.com. And Corey McFadden, she runs the site glitterandbubbles.com, which is written by mother and daughter. She's also created Glitter and Bubbles Moms Crew, a group of non-traditional moms looking for unexpected events and outings. Corey, Sita, and Andrea, good to see you. Thanks for being here. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You. Thank you.
All right, so first off, I mean, this is a big holiday for you guys. You all have young children. What does Mother's Day mean to you? Why don't we start with you, Andrea?
Oh, Mother's Day is probably my favorite holiday. I'm overly sentimental about it, actually, and I'm not a sentimental person, but I really enjoy the day. Yeah, I do.
Is there expectation to it? I mean, do you feel like it has to be a certain way? It has to be perfect, or is it more reflective?
It's more reflective for me. It used to be. I had massive expectations in the beginning, and I got a drink spilled on me, you know, a couple times at brunch, and I was like, yeah, this isn't gonna go like I think it's gonna go. So I need to adjust here.
There's a lot of motherhood and is about adjusting expectations.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, that's it in a sentence. We're done.
We're done.
Oh,
okay.
Goodbye.
All right, King Tuff coming up here. Sita, what are you looking forward to for Mother's Day?
Oh, for Mother's Day. This year will be my first year where I won't spend the whole day with my kids.
Interesting.
Again, kind of like with Andrea, Mother's Day was like a bit stressful, like wanting to go to the fancy brunch, yelling at everyone because they weren't cooperating and getting ready. So I'm going to spend the morning with them. My son Stone has a baseball game at noon. And then after that, I'm going to have tea with my girlfriends.
There you go.
So that's setting a new tradition.
Yeah, that is good. And is that difficult for you to let go of what that expectation is, or
this
start a new
year,
tradition?
No. You know, I was the mom who probably judged, like, I can't believe they don't want to be with their kids. But I mean, this will be my 7th year as a mother. My oldest son, Clark, will be 7 in August. And 3 years or 4 years of just constantly being upset because I have to still take care of everyone on what's supposed to be my one day.
Right.
So
right.
I'm going to take care of myself and give myself some time.
I like
myself.
That. All right, Corey, what are you looking forward to?
So it's pretty much the one day of the year that I get to sleep in. My husband is amazing and wonderful, but he's also Greek. And with that comes a lot of traditional ways of parenting, which means that I get up and I kind of do the hustle. So on Mother's Day, I didn't have a lot of expectations because with holidays, he's like a 3. But on Mother's Day, he has exceeded all my expectations, and now he has set forth, well, this year he better come turn up, because last year was amazing, and I think having no expectations was the best way.
Right.
Because otherwise you kind of create disappointment, because you want things perfect and this and that. So with me, I'm like, we're at 0. Mm-hmm. So as long as we don't go into the negative range, you're like, you are good.
I like it. It's good. That's a good way to set expectations. You know, are you reflective about the holiday? Do you think about being a mother, what it means to be a mother? Do you I also will ask the question of all of you, is that there always seems to be a dual role, in the sense that not only are you celebrating your motherhood, but your mother's motherhood. So how do you, first of all, talk about how reflective you are, but also then talk about just that balance of both, you know, being the mother and celebrating mother?
So I think on Mother's Day, I'm not necessarily like reflective just on that day. I can tell you though, like, I love being a mom. And every day when I look at my daughter, like, I sit there and kind of meditate in a way of like how blessed I am to be her mom. So for me, it's like I kind of live that in my daily stride. It's not about just one day celebrating it, but it is nice for me to be celebrated on that day for the role that I play in her life.
Yeah. Sita?
For me, Mother's Day is bittersweet. So with Clark, I struggled with infertility for 2 years. So I also paid a lot of money to get pregnant, you know, to become his mother through tons of in vitro treatments. But I also lost my mom 10 years ago. So I spend the whole day reflecting. I go to her gravesite that morning, and then I'm with my boys. But I spent the past 4 years trying to make Mother's Day perfect. And then I also think of all the women that are struggling with infertility on Mother's Day, because it's a tough holiday when you want to have a baby, like, but then I learned to appreciate my kids, because my son Stone came completely unassisted medically, so I wanted more than one child. I wanted three, and I get
so,
to celebrate that.
That's and you hear that a lot with people who choose to do IVF, is that you will have those situations where you'll have one child who is assisted, and then the second child is on the, that's amazing.
That's why they're 18 months apart. It's like, whoa, what? Seriously? That happened on its own?
I also would say, just in doing simple math, if you lost your mother 10 years ago, she hadn't had a chance to see your family.
Right.
So how does that play into how you think about the holiday, and knowing that you have this family and that your mother wasn't around to
see that's this? Why it's a little bittersweet. Because I would want nothing more than to have her meet them and see them. But I know she's with us in spirit. And so I take them to the graveyard as well. And I mean, it creates a tough conversations early on, but it's my reality. Yeah. And I've learned to adjust to it. That's yeah. Right.
And Andrea, I'll ask you, I mean, we started by being reflective, but for you, I mean, how do you balance both being a mother and celebrating mother on a day like Sunday?
So I start the morning and I call my mom and I apologize.
I like that.
I do. I call her and I say, God, Mom, you know, there are all those times I was so hard on you. I hope she's listening. If not, can I send her this recording?
Sure,
so then
sure,
I don't have
course,
to do
of
it.
Course.
You know, there's all those times I was so hard on her, or even in adulthood, like in my 20s before I had kids, and just thinking like, oh, you know, why did she do this or why did she do it that way? And I think once we have kids, it just kind of puts it into perspective about, you know, it really comes from love. It really, really does. Even if it's not manifesting that way, you know, if she's texting me and she's like, there's a storm. Do you realize there's a storm? You need to get home. How's the weather in Chicago? It sounds psychotic.
There you go.
So much that she just, you know, she wants me to know that there's a thunderstorm coming.
Yeah, right. Right.
And I get it. I look at my kids and I think, like, am I going to do the same things to you that she did to me? And probably not the same things, but something different that's going to drive them crazy. And I don't know, that's a day to just kind of celebrate all that, I guess.
We're talking motherhood in advance of Mother's Day on Sunday. Andrea Levoff is in the studio. She is the creator of the website and web series Dope Ass Mom. Sita Walters, who is the fashion lifestyle blogger at clarkandstone.com. And Corey McFadden, who runs the site glitterandbubbles.com. We'll take a quick break. We will come back, continue the conversation. So stay with us. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. We're talking Mother's Day and motherhood in studio tonight. Andrea Levoff, who is the creator of the web series and the website Dope Ass Mom. Sita Walters is a mother of two boys and also a successful fashion and lifestyle blogger. You can find it at clarkandstone.com. And Corey McFadden runs the site glitterandbubbles.com, which you say is a blog by both mother and daughter, which I love. Your daughter plays a big role in your blog and your website, and it's really fun to watch the interaction. All of your sites, it brings up this idea and this notion of the society or the media's portrayal of motherhood. And I see it a lot. I've been paying attention to it and listening to it just in the last couple of days, this idea of even the matriarch, this concept that the mom is someone that she dedicated her entire life to you as a kid, and you better treat her right on Sunday, and it almost sets up this she sacrificed her life for you guys. And I was thinking more about that, knowing you guys were coming in today, about the stereotypes about motherhood and how all three of you that have your own brand and you're able to talk about motherhood in non-traditional type ways. How do you see the character or the stereotype of motherhood evolving?
Well, I see it. I mean, I just see it in my friends that are moms, and I see it, you know, all the women that I hang out with that are mothers. And it's just, there's not a stereotypical mother, and certainly not the one that I thought of growing up or the people that I'm hanging out with. So if she's out there, I don't know where she is because I haven't met her. And I do think that I even thought, even my mom, or thinking about my grandmother, and I might have had this idea of her, I think if I had really, you know, taken the time to get to know her, or had the ability to know her like that as a child, I would see that that was just a myth.
Yeah,
and that was never really
born in an ad right. room somewhere,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, what do you guys think?
I mean, it's 100% an ad room. I mean, I, like you just said, Andrea, I don't know that mom that exists the way that, I think, too, mom's role has changed over time. So many of us are working, have professional careers, and so that kind of stay at home, like we think, keep the house perfect, dinner's ready on the table. Like, a lot of us are literally thinking, like, how are we going to get dinner on the table? So there's no perfect calendar or way of doing things. Mm-hmm. But I just do what I feel is right. And I think everyone is different. Everyone leads their life differently. And if you just do it from a place of what feels right to you, then I think you're right. doing the right thing. Quit looking at what's around you, trying to compare yourself to other moms. She's doing it better than me. The Pinterest mom, we have all these different categories. It's like, what's right for you and your family? Every family is different.
Sita?
Same for me. I was a stay-at-home mom, and I felt like I killed myself trying to be the perfect stay-at-home mom, which is why I launched a blog, because I said, okay, enough of this. Plus, I feel like it kind of like creates this distorted reality for your kids, in the sense that my whole life did revolve around them, and I felt they needed to see me have a life outside of them, and to see me be passionate about something outside of them, so that they can learn the world doesn't revolve around
them.
Yeah,
like, there's something there. I mean, there is. That's maybe would get to the heart of what I was trying to get at, this concept of there almost is this appreciation that's thrown out at Mother's Day to say, you dedicated your entire life, you made it all about me, you put everything to the side right. so you could be a mother to, so here's some flowers. But
diamonds.
It's not like that. I mean, it's not like that it's in not, the sense yeah. that you're seeing more. It may be, as we shift the paradigm, to think that women and mothers showing different sides of themselves, and maybe dispelling that myth might be a different or better way to parent.
Right.
Right. Yeah, and I think talking about it and just acknowledging how hard it is, or, you know, how
right.
it's not always roses. We don't always enjoy it. It's, you know, there's
and
days
it's
where...
Okay yeah, and it's okay to say that out yeah. loud. Because yeah. I feel like women don't say that. There are some days I don't like my kids. Yeah. Like, and my inside voice, I want to punch you in the face. But I can't say that out loud.
You can say it out loud to me, girl.
But we're going to say it to you. You have those days, and it's okay. Like, I just feel like you drive yourself crazy trying to be perfect of what you think is the perfect image, like, as a woman, as a mom, and there's no perfect mom. Like, you make your own, like, mom journey, like,
for sure.
Yeah,
I feel like I'm a perfect mom to my child.
I think
quite honestly, like,
us three.
I really like, but I think that I do things, I don't do them from what others put pressure on me. I just do it for, like I said, what works right for our family. And I just shut out the noise, because I think social media distorts all of us in so many ways. And we see these filtered lives. And so you follow all these moms you think are fabulous. And then you start to think, like, oh my gosh, I have to make, like, these, like, origami, like, cupcakes that don't even exist for my child's birthday party. Like, see, that's, like, crazy.
I was crazy.
I made origami cupcakes.
My favorite thing is the Pinterest fails, where it's, like, you got, like, the Elmo cupcake, like, the perfect one, and then side by side is, like, the melting Elmo face that's, like, the eyes are falling off. Like, that's me.
The more that we talk about it and we normalize it, I think so much for so long has been kept behind closed doors because you're ashamed, or that's not the way it's supposed to be, or fear of judgment. But when you start to normalize what is actually normal, it starts to make everyone realize we're all
change?
The same.
I mean, your mother is in a digital age. There's so much made about kids in a digital age. Like, you'll, you know, so many stories about what it's like to grow up with this technology. Yeah. But all three of you, I mean, you're mothers of a digital age. This is something new. Does having those communities, having you hear about this with mommy bloggers and all the way, but this idea of forums and community to share those thoughts that you may not have been able to share with your neighbors and your community when it was face-to-face communication when our moms had to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That maybe that is helping the fact of pulling that wall down about this perceived perfection.
Right.
Yeah.
I think forums can be a little dangerous because you're getting 50,000 moms with a very strong opinion that they think they are always right.
Right.
So I always say find some people that you kind of admire the way that they parent, you find similarities in, and kind of wean down right. what you follow. Because when you find yourself in this big cesspool, it's dangerous and it's crazy. And like, I've removed myself from a lot of them because I was like finding myself just like entertained by like others. Like,
there's a couple of crazy.
Someone will
post a picture of a rash and then they'll be like, what do you think this is? And then there's like 15. I'm like, no one here is a pediatrician. Okay.
Facebook group when the mom posted that her husband didn't come home the night before.
Lots of
what
that.
Do you think? It was hilarious.
You're like, oh,
it's not healthy.
Not helping, right.
Not healthy.
Last question, you guys, just about, I mean, we were kind of joking about taking calls and talking about Mother's Day fails and what you know, we kind of talked about expectations, but what should your family avoid on Sunday? What is it, I mean, we were kind of talking in the break about, please, your two sons, please don't fight.
Yeah, Mother's Day is the one day that I don't want to break up a fight. Like, don't wrestle your brother on Mother's Day. Like, pretend like you remember everything that I ask you to do and do all those things on that day.
What would be the drop dead for you, Andrea, that says, hey, my family, do not do that on Mother's Day?
I'll just tell you my dream. So this is my dream for Sunday. I get up, I get ready, I do my hair, I do my makeup. I don't ride with anyone in my family to the hotel to have breakfast. I'm alone in an Uber. They come later in a car together. I'm set at the table first with a champagne cocktail. They come sit down. We take a beautiful family photo. Then they are whisked away. And I stay at the table the rest of the afternoon just drinking champagne.
That's the dream.
That's the dream.
That's the dream. Okay. All right.
Bless you.
Corey, I'll give you the last word. What should people stay in your family? What should they stay away from?
So I honestly, like I said, my expectations are at ground zero. So there's really not a lot. But I have to say, if you know any single moms in your life, make sure you take the time to give them love on that day. Because I think that that's really difficult and a lot of times overlooked. And those moms work so freaking hard, and so make sure you take time for anyone that's in your circle. To really acknowledge them, because they might not have that.
All right, that's great advice. Andrea Levoff is the creator of the web series and website Dope Ass Mom. Sita Walters is the woman behind ClarkandStone.com. Corey McFadden runs the site GlitterandBubbles.com. Thanks for joining me tonight, and happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is bringing his music to Lincoln Hall at the end of May. Chicago, get in line for King Tough.
Flying on.
King Tuff is a musician, singer-songwriter, who is also known as Kyle Thomas. He just put out his fifth studio album called The Other, which is a bit of a departure from the garage rock and style of the tremendous catalog of full-length EPs and live albums. The Other was put out by Sub Pop Records. The new work, just released in April, is getting great reviews, and it's showing a softer, more explorative side to King Tuff. But don't worry, there's still plenty of vintage Tuff to go around. King Tuff will be at Lincoln Hall on the 25th. But first, he's my guest tonight on The Download, Kyle Thomas. King Tuff, welcome to The Download. We appreciate you taking some time out.
Hi, thank you.
Is it fair for me to say that this is a departure or at least a new style for King Tuff with The Other?
It's just a, I'm just traveling a little bit, you know, down the road. I'm just exploring the jungle.
I love the music. I love the album, everything about it. And it does sound, and this is no disrespect to the other music that you've produced, which has been great as well, but it sounds more produced. Talk about what went into and the evolution of The Other and why you went in this route as opposed to the route that you've done with the other studio albums.
I guess I just went back to doing it all myself. I recorded it at home in my home studio. So I'm happy that you think it sounds well-produced, because I had no idea what I was doing. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to hear all about, was it called a Pine Room? Is that what it's called?
The Pine Room.
What made you set up a home studio?
There's this room in my house, the Pine Room, that my friend Sam lived in for a while. And then when he moved out, I decided to take it over, because the wood paneling just screams make a record inside of me. But it's a magical place.
You joke about the idea of not really knowing what you were doing, but there is some truth to that you got a lot of equipment, you put it together, and you were experimenting. Talk about the emotion that goes into wanting to do it yourself but not necessarily having all of the knowledge in front of you.
Yeah, I think there's something beautiful about not knowing how to do something. Like, a lot of times you see art made by people who are not trained, didn't go to school, and their art is the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, because it has this sort of beginner's mind to it. Not that I was a total beginner like that with engineering or anything, but I don't know anything technical about it. I'm just kind of twisting knobs until I think it sounds right. But I definitely think that my lack of knowledge in the technical part of it helped me get more interesting sounds.
Yeah.
Because I was making mistakes and using the mistakes.
I love the contrast, and you talk about this a little bit. The Sub Pop bio talks about this too, this contrast between that voice inside of you that says, stay put, don't change, what you're doing is fine, almost pulling you back, and the artist in you, the creative side that says, this may be the unknown, but this is where I want to go. Talk about that contrast as an artist and how that fuels the work that you do as King Tuff.
I think it's important to, as artists and or in anything you do, to face fear and, you know, tackle your fears head on and get over them. So there was so much of that I had to do with making this record. I didn't know what I wanted it to sound like. I didn't know if I could do it justice. I didn't. And like, the record started with me writing the record to perform some solo concerts, which were always the scariest thing to me. So once I did those, I kind of broke through. And, you get power from that.
There's something wonderful about the character King Tuff that you play, because it's hard to imagine, anyone who's familiar with your music, it's hard to imagine you'd be scared by anything or a solo show or anything that might have to do with stage work, because this character is loud, is courageous, I guess you would say, is balls to the walls. I mean, everything about King Tuff screams that you have no fear. So it is interesting to know that the actual artist behind the character does have at least a relationship with fear.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, every musician has that. It's just about, you know, which ones are good at hiding it, you know.
Well, and the character King Tuff is a hard-partying, debaucherous character who gets up there, who doesn't give a care. Talk about where that character comes from. Is that the id of Kyle, or is that something that you made up essentially to mimic or to mock rock stars?
I never intended anything to be a character. You know, King Tuff has always just been me. It was just the name I put on my music. It was not intended to be a character. all those things which you listed were really nothing I ever intended either. You know, I've never been a hard party, or I've never been that character, but somehow that's the impression that people got of me. So it kind of became a character in other people's minds, not necessarily mine.
That's interesting. How do you deal with that? Is when the press or fans or whatever feel like they can make that you've made an impression on them that's starkly different than who you are?
Well, I think that was kind of the idea behind this record, is to maybe shed some of that and kind of show a little bit more of my true self.
It's stunning, too, because you have been a pioneer when it comes to garage rock and the DIY scene, and you've played a lot of unique type shows in different spaces. And as you evolve, as you know, and do this record, the other, and King Tough, you know, goes back out on the road, which you do endlessly, will it be a change? Will you start to see a different persona, a different style of show that comes out of the music that you produced on the other?
I think so. You know, I have a whole new band, which I'm really excited about. We're getting our looks together, you know. We're getting the stage together. We got new sounds, you know. It's much more of a, I'd say, I'm trying to get the moshers to maybe groove a little more.
I'm sure they're going to appreciate that.
You know, they can still bump into each other, but like do it in a sexy way.
That's right. What do you see next for you? Do you go right back into touring? Do you just support the record until it's time for new music? How does your process work when you're coming up with new projects?
I mean, I've definitely never been able to tour and write at the same time. So it's just kind of the reality of it, is that I'm going to tour, you know, all summer and then into the fall, and then hopefully start recording again. But yeah, it's not always easy to jump back and forth between the two.
Right.
But I have a lot of new ideas musically, even since making this album, that I want to explore. And I just want to keep experimenting and discovering new ways that new places I can take this.
Well, we look forward to new stuff from King Tough, who will be at Lincoln Hall at the end of May, May 25th. The new album is called The Other, put out on Sub Pop. Kyle, King Tough, thanks so much for taking some time out to talk to us now. We appreciate it.
No, thank you.
I'm going back to the edge of the earth, looking for an old friend. I didn't know when we said goodbye that I wouldn't see you again. Still see your smiling face in all the stars of outer space. Here one moment gone in a flash, 'cause we all like a sequin dress, bouncing off your blue eyes. You put it on, you started to dance, till you turned into the blue sky. I still see it in the summers of my brain, see it in the rainbow, see it in the rain. Here one moment gone in a flash, 'cause we all
those events are always fun. They really do a great job. May 18th will be the last one here at the Trip Tower, right here in Pioneer Court. A lot of great, it's so great. A lot of great WGN former staff come out, listeners come out, there are a ton of people walking by. The stage is set. Everyone puts on a sport coat. Well, not everybody. I believe it was last year that you came out with a sport coat, Pete. That was an impressive.
Yeah, I did.
It felt like it was, I was like, who's this guy? So that was nice.
It's not my traditional look.
Yeah. You should be a guy who, like, you know what you would be good as? A sport coat with the untucked shirt and the jeans, you know, like that you're almost like a writer-producer from L.A. You got
your
New York
you
Mets.
Think I could pull that off?
Billy Crystal hat on.
I don't know.
You don't know? Yeah. Anyway, I love those events. It's amazing. It's a week from now. It's next Friday, the 18th.
Yeah, what's the weather going to be like? Hope it's going to be...
I don't know. Let me check my app that's always wrong.
My wife is, she's doing a couple of craft fairs, so she's done them over the past couple of weeks. We have one this week in Pilsen, the Renegade Craft Fair.
Yeah.
And this one is different in that it's outside. Mm-hmm. In May can be, you know, it's tenuous.
Yeah, right. Let's take a look.
So, yeah. So I've been obsessed with this weather app. I'm looking at it like every 2 minutes.
What day is it? What, Saturday?
Saturday and Sunday.
There's a lot of lightning bolts in that. I know. That area.
And then I'm angry that, like, well, I'm sure they have a backup of some sort. If it's pouring rain, right. I got to stick inside somewhere, right?
No.
Rain or shine.
Rain or shine.
But yeah, that app changes every time I look at it. So like 65.
And we've become slaves to it because White Sox baseball.
Right. Yeah.
If they rain out, we're on call.
Yeah.
And so we have to be ready for those games. So you have to. So I'm putting into the iPhone app. I'm putting Oakland. California weather. Yeah. And then I forget to replace, I forget to delete it. So like when I open it up, I'm like, what? Why do I have Colorado weather on my phone? And I'm like, oh, that's right. They're playing the Rockets.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that's, I gotta go through and do a wholesale delete on all the towns. But yeah, they got some coming up. They got where are they going to be at the beginning of, I know they get the Rangers are coming to town next weekend, but in the beginning part of the week, they're somewhere. And it's the same thing. We will be looking at the app to make sure there's no rain delays. All right, coming up, Molly Crabapple will join us. She is the artist and writer, and her new book, which is out now, is called Brothers of the Gun. Tremendous artist. I'm so looking forward to talking with her coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest was just in town to speak at the Chicago Humanities Festival. Molly Crabapple is an artist, a journalist, and an author. Her illustrated memoir, Drawing Blood, came out a couple years back, which chronicled her life from living in a bookstore in Paris to sketching court proceedings at Guantanamo Bay. Her work is stunning. It uses photos from war-torn areas of the globe, then using ink to sketch the photos, making artistic, powerful, in a way, making them more real. Crabapple's new book is called Brothers of the Gun, A Memoir of the Syrian War. It's co-written by exiled Syrian journalist Marwan Hisham, and it's illustrated by Crabapple. The memoir is a stunning look at life and revolution and a life lived in a country torn apart by war, politics, and ideology. Also, just a life lived. That's the beauty of it. Marwan and Molly have worked together to bring sketches alive through places like Vanity Fair, but now the whole story is in memoir form. Molly's also worked for the New York Times, Vice, and The Guardian, just to name a few. Like I said, Crabapple in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. She's my guest tonight at the big table. Molly, thanks for being here.
Oh, man, thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about this first, Brothers of the Gun. You have worked with Marwan before in bringing some of these excerpts to life through Vanity Fair, like I mentioned, some other places. Talk about putting this together, having this actually done. What's it mean to you to have this book out?
It's the hardest and most precious thing I've ever done in my life, probably. Me and Marwan, we got to know each other on Twitter in 2014. Initially, we just were people that would make snarky jokes at each other on Twitter. And then I started learning Arabic, and he started helping me with that. And our collaboration started because I asked him, I was like, hey, Marwan, do you have those photos on your phone of daily life? The kind that, you know, we all have lots of photos. Right. And he was like, yeah, sure, I'll give you some photos from Raqqa. And then instead, like a lunatic, he goes around and sneaks all around the city and takes these surreptitious photos of life under ISIS, something I never would have wanted him to do because it's so incredibly dangerous, but he did that. And he gave them to me to draw from. And it was the most surreal and intense thing to be able to see the city that the only way a Western journalist went into Raqqa was in an orange jumpsuit to be in an execution video. And to see that city through his eyes and to know all the risk that he took for that. So we published that initial collaboration in Vanity Fair. And Marwan had told me that he liked to write political commentaries just in his spare time. And so I said, why don't you write some captions for this and introduce people to Raqqa a bit? It's your hometown. And he wrote those. And from that, we did a series of collaborations. He went to Mosul and later to rebel-held East Aleppo and then later finally to Turkey, where I met him in person. But to do the memoir was something entirely different than that. To do the memoir was like excavating memories, excavating the most raw and hidden, perhaps, parts of one's brain and one's past and trying to create something true. Marwan is an incredibly sarcastic, impious person. And by impious, I mean skeptical of the dogmas that are usually imposed on people. He's not someone who belongs to any ideology except his own and who only listens to his own conscience. And so it was amazing to look at a war like Syria that's so driven by ideology, that's so driven by people who look at, you know, teams and geopolitics, and work with someone who is such an individual and who had such a strong inner voice to bring his memories to life.
As an artist, to get this project started and then to recognize that Marwan is sending you photos from an area that you can get a lot of trouble for doing that, what did you expect to get? What was the expectation? Were you just assuming it'd be, okay, he's going to go to the town square and he's going to grab a couple pictures, or, oh, this could be the worst? Talk about your expectations of receiving those photos.
So I didn't think he was going to take any new photos for me. I never would have asked someone to take photos in Raqqa for me. That's be crazy. I thought that he probably just had a bunch of photos on his phone already, right? I got 1,000 selfies on my phone, certainly. But in terms of what it was like to get them, so ISIS bans photojournalism. The only images from ISIS territory are either their own depraved propaganda or it's stuff that really, really brave activists are sneaking. And photos like that, they're not taken with craft or skill. They're taken by people who are desperately trying not to get caught.
Absolutely, right.
And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to create imagery of life in ISIS-occupied city that had all of the craft and rigor and care that photojournalism does, and I wanted people to look.
The sketches in the book, Brothers of the Gun, A Memoir of the Syrian War, they're stunning. I mean, everything about it, because your artwork is stunning. There's a lot about it where you're like, that is an amazing, even on the cover of, you know, someone playing a machine gun like a violin, and it's a sketch. It's almost more real than if you had a picture of this. When you think about the project, and this project you mentioned, 2014, 2015, the book is out now, it's 2018. Raqqa is an entirely different city, and a lot of the landscape, and I would assume a lot of the backdrop of the sketches and the work that you did are not there anymore. The bombing hadn't happened. The Americans hadn't come in. A lot has changed. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about having this almost captured in a moment and knowing that a lot of the stuff is not there anymore?
You know, it's a strange thing. It's quite melancholy, right? I remember when ISIS finally left Mosul, one of their last acts was that they destroyed this very, very, very famous, very old mosque in Mosul. And I remember watching that on Twitter. And we were talking with Marwan and we were saying how happy we were that we had captured that. At this point, 90% of Raqqa was destroyed by the American bombing campaign. Mm-hmm. Much of what we drew in East Aleppo is destroyed. Turkey has just invaded Afrin, which we also drew. So these are things that are gone, that no one will ever be able to sketch from life again. No one will ever be able to take pictures of them again. And I suppose I feel privileged, very, very privileged to have drawn them. But what an intense tragedy their loss is.
And there's something to be said about the archive, any sort of photo archive of a place that is now markedly different. And that's what I think is really stunning and really powerful about your work, is that because you took the time to sketch, to make this a piece of art, those backdrops, even some of the simple stuff, like just what's happening in the town square or what's happening in someone's living room, it's not the same anymore.
Yeah, it's not the same anymore at all. I mean, the U.S., as is their wont, is not rebuilding Raqqa, just like they did not do a good job of rebuilding Baghdad in Iraq. There's still no power and there's still no water. People still can't go back to their homes because there are rotting bodies inside them very often. And so even the pictures that are just from, like, you know, normal, you know, life, that normal life has fundamentally changed.
Molly Crabapple's my guest. She's an artist, an illustrator. She's a journalist. She's an author. Her latest, Brothers of the Gun, co-written memoir of the Syrian War with Marwan Hisham. She was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about your career. Molly Crabapple in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the big table, Molly Crabapple, who's an illustrator. She's a journalist and author. Brothers of the Gun, A Memoir of the Syrian War is her latest. She co-wrote it with Marwan Hisham. She took a lot of Marwan's photography and sketched it out. It's unbelievable, powerful stuff in this book. And also, of course, she did her memoir, her illustrated memoir, Drawing Blood, back in 2015. You've got such an interesting story, how you got here, how you became one of the more well-known illustrators in this country, in the world, really. Let's go to New York. Let's go to Manhattan. Let's go to down by Wall Street and how you started working at the Box, the nightclub, and started your career, essentially your art career, almost began in earnest at this point. Talk about that experience.
Oh, man. So I was 24. It must have been like 24 years old. It's crazy that because it was right during the financial crash, which was 10 years ago. So I was 24 years old. And Box was the most depraved, crazy, rich, elite, gorgeous horror show in the city. It was the type of place where you have like Saudi royals and bankers that wrecked the economy.
Stuff we don't even didn't even know exist.
Right? Exactly. And on stage, you have like some beautiful woman who's a crazy circus performer doing a backflip and catching herself with her feet before her head would be cut off with a chainsaw. I mean, it was madness. It was absolute madness. And it was also, it was so gorgeous, but it was so on edge, right? Because we as performers were all broke and we are surrounded by these very, very rich people who are quite horrid and they have contempt for us and we had contempt for them, but also like my performer friends wanted their money and they thought my performer friends were hot. And so, you know.
Yeah. And talk about what you were doing. I mean, you were doing sketches at the club.
So I talked my way into being the club's official Toulouse-Lautrec. I sat in the corner many nights every week and I drew all the madness around me. And I convinced my boss at the Box to let me make their symbol a pig snorting cocaine.
Good. It was a very persuasive argument.
True, you know?
Yeah. But to be in that environment, to be in a decadent environment like that, right in the shadows of Wall Street in New York City, right before the economic crash, to think about that experience and what you've done since that time, when you were there when the economy crashed and Wall Street changed and you were right there in the shadows, what convinced you to move on from that place? What was it about your experience being in that area that really started moving you towards the career you have now?
Well, I actually think a lot of the skills that I use as a journalist are very similar to what I use as nightclub artist. You draw fast, right? You learn to simplify. You learn to get the truth in as few lines as you can because things are going to move really, really fast. But I think in many ways, the Box was the best training for what I did. I always think back to Toulouse-Lautrec's Moulin Rouge, which was a similar place in a lot of ways. It was a place where like European aristocrats might be in the audience, right, but where the performers were these tough as nails, you know, usually sex workers who would kick the hat off of the head of the Prince of Wales just to show like, okay, you own the world, but in here I'm queen of this place. So for me, it was nightclub as class war at the Box, and it was a perfect preparation.
And really got your name in witness journalism and sketching through your work with Occupy Wall Street, a movement that we're very familiar with, and it became front page news after the economic crash. Activists and protesters went down to Wall Street and really started a movement to say enough is enough of the inequality in this country and the 1%. It became a huge, huge movement, and it was documented well. And there's so much made about that witness journalism, people being able to turn their cameras on or turn their phones on or whatever it might be. And in your case, you took the skills that you had as a sketch artist and you sketched that movement. I saw a lot of that stuff. That became almost an artistic way to look at what was happening in Wall Street. How did you get into it?
Occupy Wall Street happened about half a block away from me. I got into it because it was right next to me. You know, so I have always gone to protests. My dad is Marxist. I went to a lot of anti-Iraq war protests, especially. But there's always this aspect about going to protests, which reminded me of going to church when you don't really believe in God, but aren't totally sure. And you think like, well, it's probably, you know, it's not going to do any harm, you know, if I go to church and it's, you know, a good thing, but you don't really expect anything to happen.
Right.
And Occupy was different. Occupy, when I was there, was the first time when I actually saw power be threatened. I mean, they were scared, right? That's why they reacted with such violence to it, because they were scared. And so I wanted to support that however I could. And for me, the way to support that was by drawing.
To think about that movement or the identity of that movement was to speak truth to power and the power's reaction. And we saw a lot of harrowing images of police and full arrests and trying to take back a little park in New York City, right in Wall Street. But we saw this thing that was happening that a lot of people I think around the country fundamentally agreed with this idea of the way that power and money was at the top and the rest of us be damned, even to the point of crashing the economy, manifesting it through the eyes of kids. Really, this movement of kids that were changing the world. To be in that moment, to be there, to be the person who was in charge of doing that fast sketch, as you talked about, and capturing that moment. Did you feel a responsibility? Were you sketching for the protesters, or were you sketching for the world to see it?
Sometimes both. Sometimes I would make signs for the protesters, and within an hour after them being online, they'd be on the streets. Other times I would just be documenting in my own sketchbook. But for me, it was probably the most vivid time of my life. There are certain times where, just for some magic reason, right, the rhythm to which your heart is beating, I guess, the rhythm to which that you're living is just in tune to that which the world is moving. And when you're in that moment, everything you do, it just feels right and it feels significant. And the friendships you make there are the ones that last forever, right? The art that you make there is so raw. And that only lasts for one brief thing. I mean, Occupy lasted 3 months, I think.
Yeah, right. It had such a lasting impact.
Exactly, exactly. But those networks that came out of Occupy, those friendships, those skills, those experiences, those are still around right now. And I've often thought that not just me, but many of my friends were still kind of like this class of 2011 that came into ourselves during that moment.
Molly Crabapple's my guest. She's an artist, sketch artist, journalist, and the author of Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian War, co-written with Marwan Hisham. All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. And I want to continue because you've done so much beyond. I mean, we're talking about Occupy Chicago or Wall Street, which, you know, now we're, you said, 10 plus years ago. You've done much since then, and I want to talk about Guantanamo Bay and some other aspects of what you've done with your work and your art. Molly Crabapple, just in town to be at the Chicago Humanities Festival, my guest tonight at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio tonight, Molly Crabapple, a great sketch artist, illustrator, journalist, author. Her new book, Brothers of the Gun, a memoir of the Syrian War. She co-wrote it with Marwan Hisham, which takes a look at life, normal life, in 2014, 2015 in Raqqa, Syria. Marwan and two of his friends essentially talking about what happened from the protests at the beginning of what we knew to be the Syrian conflict and, of course, what has happened since. You, as an illustrator, I want to talk about perception. Think about two things. I think about sketches in general, just the art form of sketches. And for whatever reason, we see them play out more often than anywhere else, either in a museum or a gallery or in a courtroom. And I wonder how that messes with our perception, because you've done a tremendous job with this stuff, where it automatically makes me, I have to get past my perception to go, this is, you took a photo and you did this. This is amazing. This is not just you sort of seeing something and doing it. But also in a lot of your work, you are able to put political commentary, your own artistic statement on it. So it may not necessarily be a full just sketch as we know it, like a courtroom thing, like here it is. You're actually making it much more nuanced. Talk about getting over that perception as people who consume your art or appreciate your art have to almost get past the way we know sketches in this world.
Oh, it's totally true. Because the thing about the difference between a sketch and a photo is that a photo is proof, right? Or it's supposed to be. I mean, obviously there's, you know, Photoshop, but in general, when you see a photo, you think that's something that happened. Whereas with a sketch, it has no such a burden on it, which right. often gives you a great deal of freedom. And I need to actually talk a little bit about the process of the work that I did in Brothers of the Gun. All my initial collaborations with Marwan were from his photos, but Brothers of the Gun was a little different because it actually takes place across his whole life. And so things...
So you have to almost take the passage and sketch
exactly.
the passage, right?
And so what we would do is I let him art direct me more than anyone has ever been allowed to art direct me in my life because I'm a little egomaniac. But what we would do is he would describe really closely something. Like he'd say, this was... there are these two women, and they were, you know, Yazidi women, and one of them was holding her baby. And he'd be like, this is how old one was, and this is how her hands were held. And, you know, make her hands careless. Don't make it some fake, cheesy Madonna and child-like Christian thing. No, it has to be real. And, like, the girl, make her younger, but also make her eyes like this. And we would work together, and we'd do sketch after sketch after sketch after sketch. And I would look at, like, for instance, how Yazidi women might typically dress. also I'd look at maybe some of my own sketches, because I had been in Iraq, and I'd also spent some time with Kurds, including Yazidi Kurds in Iraq. And we would use all of this reference and all of these memories and work to get something that was as true as possible, where no photo reference existed.
As someone who's worldly in the fact that, as I mentioned in the lead, you lived in a bookstore in Paris, and you just mentioned you spend your life in different places. And I think about the American perception of the Middle East, and I know this, and you've referenced this before as well, that most time we see any photography or imagery that is coming from the Middle East, it's surrounding war. It's surrounding some sort of chaos. That's something that I think is because the nature of the way that news is given to us. Rarely do we see normal life. You know, the idea of people just living in Raqqa, Syria. Do you have to think about that as well? Do you have to get over your perceived stereotypes or notions when you're talking with Marwan and he's saying, it's this, this, and this? Do you as an artist have to be like, almost push back against what your automatic thought is on that because of the way that we've been conditioned?
So when I started reporting in the Middle East, yes, but I've, you know, it's been some years now. Right, right. So I've been 5 years about reporting on the Middle East. And also, it's not just about the Middle East. It's that I'm not a survivor of a war. I am not someone who has lived in a city that was being continuously bombed. And I think that when you haven't lived through that, you have a perception of what you think it will be like, and you think it will be this state of exception, right? But that for people who have actually lived through atrocities, people who have lived through war, people who have, like, I was recently reading the memoirs of someone who had survived the Warsaw Ghetto, for instance. Mm-hmm. The thing about that is actually things stay normal and feel normal for so long. You don't actually get into that state of exception when you're living it. That's something that you imagine will happen but doesn't.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and it's something we don't think about if you never lived through it. You think if the bomb started falling in Chicago right now, we would all be in a chaotic sense of extended chaos. Like, just, but the fact is that may not be true.
Yeah, the human brain very quickly adapts to pretty much anything you put it in. It's the same reason that people who win the lottery don't stay happy forever, because the human brain just adapts to them being lottery winners within like a week. Something very, very similar happens when you're going through horror. And it's not that you're not, you know, traumatized and suffering and all of that, but just to survive, the human brain will put you into a mode where you can, mm-hmm. you know, live and put your foot forward.
You have had a tremendous life, and you're so young to have had the experiences that you've had. And I think about the life of an artist, because going back to being in your early 20s and sketching for, I would assume, for a little pay at the box, but other ways to scrape by to be an artist. Now, here you are with your second book. You've got a lot of opportunities, and things may be a lot different. But you were an independent artist who said no to the gallery system. You said no to the traditional ways that artists have been able to make money. And you had to kind of find your way. Why? Why didn't you just say, you know what, these sketches are great, I'm going to go through the gallery system, these sketches are great, I'm going to get, you know, try to find a teaching job or whatever it might be for artists. Why take the hard route?
I mean, to be honest, I would say the gallery world said no to me. I don't think I had that option. I mean, I dropped out of school, man. I can't get a teaching job. I don't have a college degree. And in terms of galleries, I never knew how to speak their language. There's like some special way that people speak in the art world that I assume you learn, but I don't know how to do it. And now I have a lovely gallery in New York that occasionally sells a piece, but through most of my career, I didn't have that. And I don't think it was a terrible loss. I think that the model of, you know, work all year on specs, putting all your own money into something and then put it in a room for a month and then hope things sell, I don't think it's necessarily
it's not a great model.
Yeah, not a great model for financial stability. I don't know. I just never had an option to do anything secure. I mean, I'm not good at anything except these things. I'm lazy and willful and stubborn, so I don't know what I would have done. I think this is my only option.
I found an article that Cory Doctorow did on his book, and Cory's been on the show. He asked you to write about how to be successful on the internet and when it comes to being an artist. But you had a number of things. That's 15 things. But five, you said, I never had a big break. I've had tiny cracks in this wall of indifference until finally the wall wasn't there anymore. What does that mean?
Well, it means that, so there's this idea that one day there's going to be this great gallery and they're going to step down and they're going to be like, you are a genius and here's a big show and lots of collectors and lots of money for you and it's all taken care of now and that's your reward for working so hard and being so humble. But that never happened to me. I've had some amazing opportunities, right? But even those opportunities don't feel like the big break. Like working on a book for 3 years is... it's a grind, man. It's a really, really hard grind, and it's something precious and that I feel so lucky to do, but it's also a grind. And doing a gallery show after you've been working for 14 years or whatever, it's awesome, of course, but it only feels like an incremental thing. But I've never, ever had someone just step down and be like, Molly Crabapple, here's your $1 million grand.
One of those people who might have been in the box is like, I remember your sketches. Here's $1 million.
Yeah. No, none of that. None of that. I think they're pretty mad at me for the first book.
Well, I wonder, too, because a lot of artists out there want to go it their own way. They want to be independent. They want to find ways to find their niche. And I think of your work and what you've done and what you stand for as an artist. And you recognize that I think that means that you have to keep working hard, even when opportunities come your way and money comes your way. You have to keep working hard, and it's not all going to be given to you, you know, as advice for a younger artist. If I'm an artist and I'm listening to this right now, what's your advice for someone who might be 22, 23 years old, who may have similar skills, who may feel like they have, because it's not that marketable, meaning being a sketch artist, there's not like, please, the world is yours. It's a difficult thing, and it's not necessarily one that has money attached to it.
First off, I would say that I wish we lived in a civilized country with public arts funding, and also a country that didn't believe in letting people die on the street of cancer because they didn't have a full-time marketing job. I wish that we lived in a socialist and civilized country, but we don't. So all of my advice is with that in mind. The first thing I would say is that everything in the world is breaking up right now, and it's in this sense of complete chaos. All these institutions are collapsing. And so because of that, the one good thing about being in a time of chaos is that there's no, like, the man isn't telling you have to be one way, right? Because the man doesn't know what the hell is going on.
Right.
So what I would suggest is to be yourself and to follow what are the things that obsess you, that you're passionate about, but to do it with, like, such rigor and to do it with such skill, to do it as best you can. Because everyone that I've seen who has been really, really successful, they all do things that no one would have imagined before. One amazing friend I have, Tatiana Fazlilizade, I always shout her out. She got tired of men harassing her on the street and men always saying, like, hey, baby, smile. So she did a self-portrait. She's a very talented charcoal artist and painter. And it's a portrait of her looking pissed off. And it says, stop telling women to smile.
Right.
And she started weed pasting that in her neighborhood where she was getting hassled. And then she started emailing her friends and talking to her friends and was like, what do you not like that men say to you on the street? And doing portraits of them with stuff like, my name isn't baby, for instance. And they started putting those over. And at this point, like, she's in all these museums. She has a book out. She worked with Spike Lee. She did stuff in Paris, in Mexico City. And I think that because she was doing something that was true and that was to herself, but she was doing it with so much skill, right? And with so much discipline.
Yeah, right.
And going out every night, you know, risking arrested, getting arrested, putting these things up, that combination is why she was successful. Whereas I think that if she tried to be one of these, like, sterile SEO managed things and was like, what's popular, that wouldn't have been successful. Yeah.
So interesting. Molly Crabapple was just in town for the Chicago Humanities Festival. Her new book, co-written with Marwan Hisham, is called Brothers of the Gun, A Memoir of the Syrian War. You can also find her illustrated memoir, Drawing Blood, as well. Molly, great to have you here at the big table. Great to meet you, and continued success with your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up tomorrow night, we're going to reload the news. We haven't had a show on a Friday night in forever. I feel like the last one we had was a rain out, if you remember that, or it was like a snow out in Minnesota in the first week of baseball back in April, the night that we bombed Syria, because we came in to do the preemption of the rain delay. Thought we'd put our feet up, have some Friday night fun, and then the president spoke to the nation and we bombed Syria. That's the last time we had a Friday night show, because the White Sox play pretty consistently on Friday nights. The Cubs, you'll find them once in a while playing day games. Wrigley, they love that Friday day game. And tomorrow, because the White Sox and the Cubs are playing in the Crosstown Classic, they're playing at Wrigley Field during the day. So we will have a show tomorrow night. So some of our old Friday night staples, we'll reload the news. Lauren Cohn will be here, as well as Ken Davis. Fun to get some regulars in here, talk about the week that was. It's going to be great. There's a lot of great stuff going on. Talk about actually international news, whether it's North Korea or what's going on with Israel and Iran and the Iran deal. We can also talk locally about the economy, talk about this crazy deal with Michael Cohen, the stories coming out that, that companies, corporations have been funneling money to him to get access to the president. That's the allegation. We'll talk about that coming up.
And if, according to my Twitter feed right now, the mm-hmm. biggest story of the week is that Brooklyn Nine-Nine was canceled.
And Brooklyn Nine-Nine canceled.
So that's right up there.
Would love to know on that story, because I saw that too, that people are outraged, fans are outraged. It seems to me that I would love to hear from Andy Samberg. Because I just have this sneaking gut feeling that he's like, it's run its course. It's time for me to do something else. He's one of these performers that can do anything, movies, albums, stand-up special, whatever he wants to do. And he's been on a sitcom for 4 years or whatever. So maybe it's really just more about him saying it's time to move.
And I've seen that other outlets, streaming outlets, have expressed interest in trying to get the show. So I don't know if this is a personal decision or
that others, just like Netflix and company, are stepping up.
Yeah,
maybe. I don't know. I mean, I always thought that was a funny show. I don't watch it that often, though.
Yeah, I watched the first couple of seasons, and then it's one of those ones where my wife doesn't like, and then so I just lose it in the relationship.
Right.
It happens. But yeah, I really liked it. And the weird thing about Andy Samberg, I always feel, is that he's married to Joanna Newsom, who is like this indie harpist.
Right, right.
Which, I don't know, it's a cool couple, but like I always forget that he's married. Yeah, he's married to that Joanna Newsom.
Yeah, right.
If you're not familiar with Joanna Newsom's work,
just Google indie
Google
harp.
It. Yeah, indie harp. Yeah, and I don't know. I don't know if they just seem like they're too dear. Like, she's just like an indie harpist, you know. And he makes funny, you know, videos about, you know, people on boats and things.
All right, save it for tomorrow, man. Save it for Reload. We're giving it all away tonight. And also tomorrow, the return of Steve Gadlin in the frying pan. How about that? The inventor who brings his latest inventions to the frying pan. He has a development deal with Mark Cuban after winning on Shark Tank for a business called IWantToDrawACatForYou.com. You may remember he did a little dance. And he parlays that by pitching Mark Cuban new ideas, but a lot of times he wants to workshop them first, so he brings them here to the frying pan before he, you know, has to work up the courage to pitch it to Cuban, because it's a little bit more formal. And so it's our job to poke holes in his ideas, and he says he's got a good one. He's excited. He's already tweeted. So excited to be back on WGN Radio tomorrow night. He's not even within 24 hours. How about that? So there you go. Steve Gadlin in the frying pan coming up tomorrow night.